Beloved Bhagwan, on one occasion, the governor said to Nan Sen, "There is a piece of stone in my house. Sometimes it stands up, and sometimes it lies down. Now, can it be carved into the image of Buddha?" "Yes," said Nan Sen, "it is possible. But it is also impossible," countered the governor. "It is impossible," declared Nan Sen. "It is impossible."
Manisha, a little note. One of Nan Sen's most famous disciples was Lu Xuan, who later became known as Rikupo Tofu, the provincial governor of the Xuan district. After residing in his mountain retreat for 30 years, without once venturing out, Nan Sen finally agreed to the governor's request to come down and teach Zen to the people on the plains. From that time, he became very well known. The governor once asked Nan Sen about the saying that all things came from the same source, so there can be no right or wrong. Nan Sen pointed to a patch of peonies in the garden and said, "Governor, when people of the present day see these blossoms, it is as if they see them in a dream." The governor has made a very important statement. If there is only one source of everything, then there can be no right, no wrong, no good, no bad, no God, no devil. And this is exactly the case. All our rights and wrongs are the judgments of the mind who knows nothing of the source. Our conceptions are moralistic. They are not religious. They are not based on the experience of the original source from where everything arises. And finally disappears also in the same source, just like waves arising in the ocean, falling back into the ocean. But to live this insight in your life needs tremendous courage. It needs a non-judgmental mind. And we have been brought up with every single thing has been judged. This is right, that is wrong, A small boy was asked in the school, "What is your name?" He said, "Don't." The teacher said, "Don't? I have never heard such a name." He said, "Whatever I do, wherever I want to go, they always say, 'Don't.' So I think this is my name." But actually, this is the case with everyone. What are your criterions of right and wrong? Who has given you the criterions? How you decide, how you judge? All of our moralities are man-made conveniences. Whatever is convenient to the society becomes moral. For example, by nature, if 100 boys are born, 84 girls will be born. By the time of their marriageable age, they will be equal. Boys die more, girls are more resistant. People think of strength only in the muscular way, but there are other ways of thinking of strength. Women have a more resistance to disease. They don't get sick so soon. And the average is that 16 boys will pop up by the time they are 14. By the time of 14, there is an equal number of girls and boys. Obviously, it is convenient to create the idea of monogamy. Otherwise, there will be very much inconvenience. One man, one woman. This becomes the right, but it is simply a convenience. To give you the contrast, in Muhammad's time, particularly in Saudi Arabia, the people were so barbarous and continuously fighting and killing, caravans loaded with goods from one country to another were looted, men were killed. In Saudi Arabia at that time, there was no other possibility to survive. Killing was the profession. So more men were killed because men were doing the killing and fighting. The proportion between men and women became so different that there were 4 women and 1 man. That was creating very much restlessness. Muhammad has to make in Quran it a moral concept to marry at least 4 women. He himself married 9 women. Of course, he is the leader and he is propounding the moral concept. He has to follow it to the very end. And even today, then it becomes foolish. Because these judgments are dependent on causes and time. Now the situation is not the same. But Mohammedans insist, even in this country, they force the Indian government to have in the constitution that Mohammedans are allowed to have 4 women. Now the whole thing is stupid. The number of women and men in Mohammedans is equal. From where they can get 4 women? So now this gives them an opportunity to steal women from other people, and Hindus and Jainas are very Puritans. If a woman has been in a Mohammedan's house for 1 night forcibly, nobody is going to accept her back, neither the husband, nor her children, nor her parents. The whole society rejects her. She is no more part of them. She has to go back and beg the Mohammedan to keep her. Now a judgment based on convenience has become a crime. And it has given birth to many crimes. All moral judgments are somehow based for the convenience of the society. They have no fundamental value. If man's nature is looked at, neither man is monogamous, nor women are monogamous. Both are polygamous. And it is absolutely natural. If we look at nature, then we should create a more flexible society where people can at least exchange their wives or husbands with their friends once in a while, by the weekend. That will create a more happy, satisfied, contented society. But that goes against all the moral concepts that the past has given to us. It is absolutely simple to understand that everybody gets fed up with one thing continuously. It is not unnatural. It says nothing about the person. However beautiful and good your wife is, she may look beautiful to the whole world and good to everybody, but think of the poor husband. How long you can go on thinking her beautiful? Perhaps by the time the honeymoon ends, she becomes obvious, taken for granted. And to go on loving with the same intensity becomes every day more and more difficult. The husband is bored by the wife, however beautiful she is. The wife is bored by the husband, however great man he may be. This boredom expresses in every activity of life. All their actions are dominated by this boredom. Their life seems to be the life of a prisoner. If they change the wife, the whole society is against. They lose their respectability. They may lose their jobs. They may become outcasts. So they go on clinging with each other. But they both go on creating misery also for each other. Now, I will not call this a morality based on clear perception. It is a morality based on an ordinary convenience. I know it will be very inconvenient if people go on changing wives. Children don't know who is the father and who is the uncle. But what is the problem in it? In fact, it will be a good chance for the children to know many fathers. It will be a preparation for their own life. Many mothers, it will be a great preparation for their own life. In the future, if society continues to exist after 2000 there is going to be an immense revolution in man-woman relationship. The whole concept of right and wrong is going to change. The The governor has asked really a fundamental question. If the source is the same, then what is the difference between right or wrong? Every moment it has to be decided by a clear conception, without any prejudice, without any pre-arranged idea. I am against morality for the simple reason that it gives you prejudices, superficial prejudices. Anything going against it, you immediately take the idea that it is wrong. It is right. It happened to Lao Tzu. The source of Taoism, that he was made the chief justice of the Supreme Court of China. He begged to the emperor that you are committing a mistake. I am not the right man. You will repent. But the emperor knew that he was the wisest man alive, and he was. There was no doubt about it. He said, why should I repent? You are the wisest man. Lao Tzu said, that is the problem. My judgment will come from my wisdom, and your judgments will never be adjustable with my judgments. But the emperor was stubborn. He said, let us see. So the first case came, a thief was caught red-handed from the richest man's house. Lao Tzu listened the whole story. The thief himself confessed that in front of you I cannot lie. If there was another judge, it was a different matter. But I have always respected you and loved you. So I say there is no need for any witnesses. I have been stealing not only this time from this same man's house, I have stolen many times. This time I have been caught. Whatever judgment you feel right, I will not complain. Lao Tzu waited for a moment and that said, to both of you, you and the man whose house you have been stealing are criminals. Both, the rich man asked, are you in your senses? Lao Tzu said, you have collected so much money that almost 50% of the wealth of the city is in your hands, and 50% in the whole city's hands. This situation creates the possibility of stealing. This man is a victim. In fact, you are the criminal. But I will be very equal 6 month jail for both. The rich man said, "My God, I have never heard that somebody steals from your house and you are jailed." He said, "I want first to see the emperor. Even the emperor owes money to me. Whenever he wants, I have been giving money to him." And he went to the emperor and said, "This has happened, and I have come to remind you that soon you will be in jail also. If this man is going to remain the supreme judge of the empire, you cannot remain out of jail long. We are small criminals according to him. You are the biggest criminal." The emperor said, "Perhaps he was right that I will repent. Don't be worried. I will release him from the service immediately." He called Lao Tzu and said, "This is a very strange judgment." Lao Tzu said, "It is not. If people were living in harmony with nature, if people were compassionate to each other, if they felt a certain brotherhood with each other, then how there can be rich people and poor people? There will be only people. And there is enough. At least in those times it was perfectly right, it was enough for everybody to live comfortably. At that time when Lao Tzu said that, in India the population was only 2 million. Now the population is 900 million. And by the end of this century, if humanity survives, the chances are very rare. India will be 100 million. For the first time, India will be the biggest populated country. Up to now, China has remained the first and India number two. In the race, India is going to win within 10 years. In those days, when the country has only 2 million people, the nature was abundant. There was no need for anybody to be rich or poor. Things could be easily, comfortably enjoyed by all. But it was not the case, neither in India, nor in China, nor anywhere else. Now it has become absolutely impossible. But Lao Tzu was right when he said that a man who collects so much wealth that thousands of people become undernourished, they don't have houses, they don't have jobs, they don't have enough to eat. What do you want? Should they steal or not? Their stealing is not a crime. This man is the criminal. What is the point of collecting all this wealth? Your wealth is simply the blood of the people. You should be happy that I am sending you to jail only for 6 months. In fact, if I am to be just, that man can go for 6 months. You have to go for your whole life. Less than that will not be justified. The emperor said, I understand. I release you. You were right that I will repent. You are a dangerous fellow. The convenience of the emperor, the convenience of the vested interest, the richest, the super rich, their convenience is the problem. Everything is right that fits with their convenience, and everything is wrong that does not fit with their convenience. All our moralities are just. Decided by the exploitative classes, the oppressors. The very people who are the cause of immorality in the society are the decisive factors of morality. Krishna had 16,000 wives. And no Hindu objects to it. He still remains God's perfect incarnation. Others are imperfect incarnations. He is the only one who is the perfect incarnation. But nobody thinks that this man has married only one woman. The remaining he has taken away from anywhere. Just he will see any beautiful woman and his soldiers will take it to the palace. She has a husband, she has children, she has old parents, or her husband has old parents, no care about anything. And one can think that Krishna must be a sexomaniac. What you will do with 16,000 women in a small life? 16,000 women, you are behaving with women as cattle. You will not even know their names. Many will not have any chance to meet you. But these are the people who make rules for the society. For the society, the rule is monogamy. Krishna is above rules. He is God's incarnation. So the oppressive society has been deciding rules for the oppressed. All moralities are criminal. Only a man of deep meditation and silence can say anything, but he will not use the word right or wrong, and he will not decide it forever as a criterion. It can only be in that moment, a spontaneous response, not a reaction. He is not deciding the morality. Looked from another point of view, there is only one thing right, and that is to be absolutely conscious. And only one thing wrong, to be absolutely unconscious. Out of unconsciousness, whatever arises is going to be wrong. Out of consciousness, whatever arises is going to be right. It is not a question of actions, it is the question from where it arises. But still it is relative. In the ultimate sense, whether it arises from unconsciousness or from consciousness, it does not matter. Everything is whatever it is. There is no question of right and wrong. Because unconsciousness and consciousness both arise from the same source. The source of eternal life. Hence it is said, the Buddha goes beyond the ordinary rules. He lives according to his own responsibility. He does not take steps according to the preordained morality. He takes steps according to his awareness, moment to moment. Ordinary people who know nothing of consciousness obviously need a certain kind of morality, a certain system of rules. But this is unfortunate. It simply shows that man has not become conscious enough. Hence he needs rules to keep him within bounds and limits. The day the whole society becomes more conscious, there is no need of morality and there is no need of government and there is no need of any courts. These are ugly things. These are insulting things to humanity. They are humiliations. The day I entered America, the man who interviewed me for my entry visa, his first question was, "Are you an anarchist?" He must have been informed, he has a whole file. I said, "I am something more." He looked a little shocked because there was no rule. He started looking in the file. In America, an anarchist cannot enter. An anarchist is one who does not believe in the government, who believes that every government is a slavery. And unless we are free from all governments, man goes on living into slaveries, changing slaveries, and thinking that he is free. His idea of freedom is just a dream. But when I said, "I am something more," he was at a loss what to do with me. He said, "What do you mean by something more?" I said, "I mean that before governments can be dissolved, man's unconsciousness has to be dissolved. I am not an anarchist, but anarchism will be the byproduct of my whole effort." He said, "You seem to be very difficult." And since that moment, for 5 years continuously, I was in fight with the American government. And we were not wrong. But their prejudices, when I said to a jailer where I was jailed that, "Do you consider that you are also a foreigner here?" No American is American. All are foreigners. The natives, the poor red Indians, they are the Americans. Americans have changed even their name, they are Red Indians. And America belongs to them. I said to the jailer, because he has become friendly, 3 days I was in his jail. I said to him that, "You are your father, are your grandfather at the most. Must have come from outside America. And I am at least having a valid passport. Your parents entered America without any passport." Your parents entered America as invaders. I have come just as a tourist. And you have killed almost 90% of the Red Indians. And the 10% that have remained alive, you have left them half alive and half dead. You have forced them in reservations into deep forests, and you go on giving them pension for what? Because you don't want them to enter in the society and work and be part of the society. To separate them, you go on giving them pensions without any work. Naturally, when you get money without any work, what you will do? Then you will drink alcohol, drugs, gambling, prostitutes. What you will do with your money? So those Red Indians have become completely destroyed. They cannot even fight for freedom, because fight for freedom means losing the pension. And it is so good to have pension. Just create more children and you have more pensions. And enjoy the life. Drink as much you want. Use drugs as much as you want. But don't go out of the reservation. Remain deep in the forest. I told him that what right you have got to prevent others to enter America. It is not your motherland. But they have made it. And nobody in the world, not even their own thinkers, ever raised the question that what about the freedom of America? When we are going to leave? And you have become dispensers of morality, judgment, courts and law and constitution, and this country does not belong to you. You are barbarous invaders. If there is any greater crime, you tell me. He said, you are right, but now it is too late. We have been here for 300 years. And what has happened. And now we cannot go anywhere. There are Italians, and there are Germans, and there are English people, and there are Spanish, and there are Dutch. From all the countries of Europe, there are people. They will not be taken back, because their own countries will not accept them anymore. So they have nowhere to go. And they are occupying a country of poor natives. You will be surprised to know that how barbarous behavior has been practiced all along the history. The whole city of Newark was purchased from the Red Indians by the so-called Americans in 90 silver rupees. Do you call it business? They were forced the whole city of Newark just in 90 rupees. All rights and wrongs up to now have been decided by who is powerful. It is the power that decides in India. They have a proverb: whoever has the staff will have the buffalo. It does not matter to whom it belongs. The question is whose staff is bigger, who is more stronger. The stronger makes the rules for the weaker. The richer makes the rules for the poorer. Naturally, those rules are in favor for the rich, for the powerful. They are against the poor and the weak. When I say I am against morality, I mean I am against this whole structure, this whole system of making rules by the powerful for the powerless. Man has made rules for women because he is more muscular. The woman is more fragile, more dependent, because she becomes pregnant. In her pregnancy, she is absolutely dependent on the man for everything that she needs. Her pregnancy has become her slavery. If the women want to be liberated from men, they should think about pregnancy first. They should insist for birth control. And they should insist that while they are pregnant, the society should take care of them. Otherwise, they are not ready to be pregnant. Pregnancy has made them handicapped, and man has exploited the situation very easily. To the man of ultimate consciousness, there is nothing right and wrong. Everything is as it is. There is no judgment. The governor has asked something very important. If all things have come from the same source, there can be no right or wrong. Nansen pointed to a patch of peonies in the garden and said, "Governor, when people of the present day see these blossoms, it is as if they see them in a dream." His answer is a little indirect, but what he is saying is that people are so unconscious that whatever they see is not more than a dream. In their dream, they decide what is right, what is wrong. When they will be awakened, they will see everything is melting into each other. There are no opposites and there are no contradictions. Existence is one organic unity, but because people are unconscious, dreaming, what are your thoughts except dreams of the day? Dreams with open eyes. And what are your dreams? Thoughts of the night. How you decide? You don't have consciousness enough to decide anything. You simply follow the old rules. But do you know that the people who have made those rules were as asleep as you are? For example, the Hindus followed the rules of Manu. 5,000 years before, he made the Hindu morality. According to him, men are divided in four castes. The Brahmins are the highest. Nobody can enter into Brahminism. You are a born Brahmin or not. Conversion is not possible. Because your being a Brahmin depends on your past life's good deeds. Now, where you will find your past life and do good deeds, that is gone. The second class is the warriors. The third class is the business people. And the fourth class, the Sudras, are untouchables. They are so dirty that their even their shadow, if passes over you, you have to take a bath. They have not touched you, their shadow has touched you. That is enough to make you dirty. The fourth class cannot be allowed to live in the city. They have to live outside the town. There are places where they cannot enter. For example, in temples they cannot enter. They cannot read the scriptures. They cannot enter into schools. They cannot be educated. For 5,000 years, nobody has revolted against it. That you are forcing a person just to be a shoemaker because he is born in the family of a shoemaker. He may have qualities of an Albert Einstein, but that door is closed. He cannot enter even in the school. He may have the qualities of Gautam Buddha, but all doors are closed. He is allowed only to make shoes. For 5,000 years, all his ancestors have been making shoes. He has to make shoes. Very strict divisions. No mobility, no movement from one profession to another profession. Manu was a Brahmin. Obviously, Brahmins are the best. They are the decisive factors. They will decide what is right and what is wrong. And the same is the situation in all around the earth. People are living in absolute unconsciousness. All these religious people, so-called, are against me, obviously. Because I am saying to them that all your moralities are of the same stuff as dreams are made of. The only possibility to know the right is first to be fully conscious. And when a man is fully conscious, things change. For example, Gautam Buddha dropped the idea of caste. Immediately, as he became enlightened, his first step was, there are no castes. Everybody has to be free to do whatever he wants, to be whatever he wants. Birth cannot decide his destiny. Buddha could not survive in India because the Brahmin's whole profession was at stake. If Buddha has spread his message the Brahmins would have lost the power that they had, the warriors would have lost the power they had, and the Sudras will enter into every place, they will have the freedom which was never given to them. Buddha can see in his silence, in his peace, that this is a stupid idea. In the name of morality, in the name of religion, it is imposed on people. It should be taken away. Freedom is the base, the fundamental base all humanity. Anything that goes against freedom goes against humanity. Manisha has asked, beloved Bhagwan, on one occasion, the governor said to Nansen, there is a piece of stone in my house. Sometimes it stands up and sometimes it lies down. Now, can it be carved into the image of Buddha? Yes, said Nansen, it is possible. But it is also impossible, countered the governor. It is impossible, declared Nansen. Yes, it is impossible. A strange dialogue. First, you have to understand that the governor is speaking in metaphors. When he says that there is a piece of stone in my house, he is talking about himself. He is saying what I am more than a stone. Sometimes I get up and sometimes I lie down. I am as unconscious as a stone. Do you think, he asked Nansen, this stone, this me, can be carved into a Buddha? It is not about a stone. It is about himself, because stones don't stand and don't lie down. They don't get tired so soon. He is talking about himself. Yes, said Nansen, it is possible. He does not say that it is inevitable. He simply says it is possible. If an urge arises in the stone, everything is possible. The stone can become a Buddha. The governor said, but it is also impossible. Seeing the governor that he cannot understand that even a stone if an urge, a longing arises in him, if he becomes a seed, will finally become a Buddha. The governor cannot understand that possibility. He says, but it is also impossible, very difficult. Nansen also said, yes, it is impossible. He repeated again, it is impossible. If you yourself think it is impossible, then there is no way. The first thing is to see and perceive your potentiality and possibility. If you yourself say it is impossible, then nobody can do it. It is not something that somebody else has to do it. You have to grow into a Buddha. If you say it is impossible, then the project can be dropped. What he is saying to you in this anecdote is that your very urge to become a Buddha ultimately discovers the Buddha in you. The Buddha is not somewhere far away that you have to go in search for. It is hidden behind you. If your urge becomes urgent, the hidden opens its doors. If you go inwards with a tremendous force to reach to the very source and the center of your being, you will find the Buddha. But if you think it is impossible, then you have yourself close the doors of your potentiality. Nobody can make you a Buddha. But it is possible if you have the passion, if you have the longing, if you turn in, dropping all mundane things of the outside, it is possible. Sekiso wrote, people's abuse has melted what was golden and it has gone from the world. Fortune and misfortune both belong to the land of dreams. Don't look back to this world, your old hole in the cellar. From the beginning, the flying birds have left no footprints on the blue sky. Sekiso is a great poet. He is saying people's abuse has melted what was golden. We have left a golden age behind. We misused it. I am reminded of a very significant incident in the Himalayan mountain range. There are few tribes, very ancient tribes. Which have followed a rule very male chauvinistic. That if you become a guest in their house, they will offer you everything, and in the night they will offer you their wife too. A guest has to be given everything. When the Britishers came to India, they exploited these poor people so much that then the areas of Manali and Kullu, almost 90% people are suffering from syphilis. And the reason was the British. When they heard that these people offer their wives, they will go for hunting into the mountains, and then in the night they will knock on some door. And those poor people, offered them everything, food, shelter, their wives. They could not think that these people have come just to exploit them, to prostitute their wives. And they spread syphilis all over the area in the whole tribe. Even children are born with syphilis. And they were not responsible for the children which were born out of their love making to those poor people's wives. So you can understand what Sekiso is saying, people's abuse has melted what was golden. There was certainly a more trusting world, more loving people, I remember even in my childhood. In my village and the surrounding villages, you could not purchase milk. You can get as much milk as you wanted, but nobody will sell milk. A nourishment and somebody is hungry and you exploit his hunger. So milk was available to anybody. Now in the same village, you will not find pure milk at any cost. Half water, half milk. In the university where I was studying, a man was supplying the milk to the students. He was a very good man, very nice man, very wise old man, and people have started calling him Santji, a saint. And he used to come with buckets of milk with his son, carrying another bucket to the hostel, and people will ask, Santji, is it true that you don't mix water into the milk? He will put his hand on his boy's head and he will say that in my whole life I have never mixed water into milk. If I have ever done that, my child would die. I heard it. I thought that this seems to be strange, because the milk certainly is 50% water. Already the milk, pure milk, is 80% water. And when you mix more water into it, 50%, it becomes so clear. So my first day in the university, when I heard him, I called him by the side and I asked, tell me the truth, because certainly your milk is full of water. And if you don't tell me the truth, I will take you to the Vice Chancellor and the milk will be sent to the scientific analysis. And if water is found in it, your whole business is finished. He said, you are the first person to create so much trouble for me. I will tell the truth. Don't do anything, but don't tell others. I said, you tell me the truth. What is the truth? He said, the truth is, I never mix water into milk. I always mix milk into water. That's why I can say without any fear, but don't send it for any scientific analysis. I will provide you water and milk free of charge. If you want without water, I will drop the water in your milk. But then you have to send somebody to my place. But don't tell it to anybody. I have told you the secret. There was a world. As far back we go, we find a certain quality of trust which was the golden age of humanity. Sekisu says, and it has gone from the world. Fortune and misfortune both belong to the land of dreams. Don't look back to this world, your old hole in the cellar. From the beginning, the flying birds have left no footprints on the blue sky. This is a saying of Gautam Buddha. He used to say that you have to follow a path which is not already made. You have to make it and walk it. You have to make it by walking it. You have to arrange your pathway. You cannot follow anybody. It is just like the sky. The flying birds have left no footprints on the blue sky. The same is true about the inner sky. The Buddhas have not left their footprints. So you cannot follow any Buddha. You have to find your path on your own, alone. This is your dignity. This is a great freedom. If there were ready-made paths, superhighways, then truckloads of people will be becoming Buddhas every day. Buses will be going. But because in the inner world you cannot take your trucks, you cannot take even your rickshaw or the rented bicycle. It will be very difficult. Riding on the bicycle, you can go anywhere except inside. Inside you have to go, not with your legs, you have to go with your vision. You have to turn your eyes in. There are no footpaths. The sky inside is absolutely untrodden. But the distance with the goal is not very big, only one step. as you look inside urgently, you can see as if you are seeing in a water hole, the water deep down. Or as if you are seeing into a tunnel, far away, the opening into the sky. There is only one step that you have to take to reach to the Buddha. Just courage and some energy for adventure, for inquiring, for exploration. But remember this tremendously beautiful statement: the flying birds have left no footprints on the blue sky. There is no possibility of being a follower. Manisha has asked, "Beloved Bhagwan, who of us here could agree that what was golden has gone from the world? How could it be when you are among us and in your presence it feels that you are filling us with gold? You are the Midas of the spiritual dimension." Manisha, this Buddha auditorium is not part of your so-called world. It is an island in itself where only Buddhas dwell. For you, as meditators, time does not matter. The deeper you go, the more contemporary you become to Gautam Buddha, to Lao Tzu, to Chuang Tzu, to all those who have experienced the ultimate. You meet them at the very source of your being. It is the same taste, it is the same flavor, it is the same goal. You are right and you are wrong. Right, because here in this Buddha auditorium you are so urgently so passionately searching for the Buddha. You are bringing a gold age in existence. But outside the gate, there is a vast world where even the idea of looking inwards does not occur to people. The idea to become a Buddha, if you tell to those people outside the gate, they will laugh. They will say, "Are you mad?" They will look at you with suspicion that this man must be on heroin. Under the influence of opium or some other drug, he is thinking to become Buddha. Buddha has died 25 centuries before. People in the ordinary world never think of themselves that they have a different destiny, not just being a businessman or a clerk or a station master or a teacher. These are not your destinies. These are your professions. Good to survive in the body, but not good enough to find the Buddha. You have to do something else. You have to enter into yourself, which is not part of the education or the morality or society. People will laugh at you that you enter in. They will say, "You are mad. How can you enter in?" We don't see any door, any window. From where you enter in, and what you can find there, just a skeleton. Don't do that. Otherwise, you will become afraid of yourself. Seeing a skeleton inside, a skull, and all the blood vessels, and the intestines, just avoid this going in. It is a very dangerous thing that you are doing. And if you really are interested, just wait when you die in your grave. Look inside, because there will be no outside anymore. Then watch your skeleton. And you have enough time, no other work. You are right that here we are exactly trying to bring the golden age back. Those who want to join in this great venture, they are welcome. But in the world, Manisha, that golden age has certainly disappeared. what is happening in the outside world you can find out from these jokes. Chester Cheese is on a long sales trip. When his car breaks down, he walks up to a nearby farmhouse and knocks on the door. "Excuse me," says Chester to the farmer, "but my car has broken down. Can I stay here for the night?" "Well, I guess so," says the old man. "But the only available bed belongs to my 16-year-old daughter, Lucy. You will have to sleep with her." "Really?" smiles Chester, and he is shown to Lucy's room. Later that night, lying next to Lucy, Chester puts his hand on her soft thigh. "Stop that," cries Lucy, "or I will call my father." But then she moves a little closer to Chester. A little while later, Chester tries again. "Stop that," cries Lucy, "or I will call my father." But then she moves even closer to Chester. On the third try, Lucy jumps on top of Chester and they have a great time. A little while later, Lucy whispers, "Mister, can we do it again?" Chester agrees, and they go for it again. 5 minutes later, Lucy is tugging again on Chester's deflated machinery. "Mister, can we do it again?" she asks. "Stop that," gasps Chester, "or I will call your father." That is what is happening in the outside. Swami Deva, clever head, the group therapist, is walking out of the front gate one night. "Hello, sir," says Black Fat, the flower seller. "Buy roses for your lovely wife." "I have not got a wife," snaps Clever Head, waving him away. "Okay," says Black Fat. "Roses for your girlfriend?" "No," screams Clever Head. "I have not got a girlfriend either." "Okay," says Black Fat. "Then buy 2 bunches to celebrate your good luck." Paddy and Samus are sitting in Paddy's yard drinking a few beers. "Hey," says Samus, "how was your boat trip to Spain?" "Fantastic," says Paddy. "Imagine, I'm away from Marine for the first time in 15 years. Then on the first night of my trip, I met this gorgeous girl, one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen. We chit-chatted for a while, and it was love at first sight. Soon we were rolling in each other's arms, completely naked. But in the morning, as I held her in my arms, I found out she is the new wife of my best friend, Fergus. It came as such a tremendous shock that we both felt really guilty. And we both cried and cried and cried. My God, says Seamus, that is really something. So how was the rest of your trip? Well, you know, says Paddy, after that it was just crying and fucking. Crying and fucking. That is what is happening in the outside world. Big Olga Kowalski's overweight wife is getting enormous. So she goes to Dr. Gasbag to see if she can get some advice. You need much more exercise, says Gasbag, and you eat far too much. You must exercise every day. But doctor, complains Olga, what exercise should I do? It is easy, replies Gasbag. Begin slowly. Just strip off, lie down on your bed and try to sit up and touch your toes. Then lift your legs back over your shoulders. Keep doing this until you start sweating of those pounds. That night, Olga decides to give it a try. Naked, lying on the bed, she can hardly see her toes. Still, she pushes forward and tries to grab her feet. Then she lifts her legs back, but she gets stuck with her bum sticking out and her legs pushed back over her head. At this point, Kowalski stumbles into the bedroom, utterly drunk. Jesus Christ, Olga, he shouts in shock, comb your hair and put your teeth back in. You look like your mother. This is what is happening in the house. Nibedino. be silent. Close your eyes. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards with totality, with all your consciousness gathered as an arrow. Go deeper and deeper. Remember, every moment can be the last moment of your life. Hence the urgency. You are not to leave this body without realizing your Buddhahood. It is possible. Even the stone can be carved into a Buddha. What to say about consciousness? It is Buddhahood itself. Rejoice this moment. Very few people in the world are even trying to know who they are. That is what is making a mess of the world. If you know consciously the source of your being, you become filled with contentment, joy, compassion, love. So many thousands of flowers blossom in you. You become a splendor. This is your birthright. You can ignore it, but you cannot destroy it. Any moment you want to remember it, it is available. Just want it enough. To make it clear, Nivedan ho. Just to watch. You are the witness, you are not the body, you are not the mind, you are only a witness, just a mirror. This witnessing is the point of departure. The point from where transformation begins. Drink deeply into the source. get soaked, drenched. So that when you come back, you bring Buddha in your heart, in your breathing. You have to live Buddha 24 hours. The evening was beautiful in itself. But the presence of so many Buddhas has made it tremendously beautiful. Gather as much gold as possible. Soon, Nivedana will be calling you back. Bring it all with you. The fragrance, the silence, the blissfulness. In this moment, there are not 10,000 Buddhas, but only one Buddha nature, one ocean where you all have dissolved. Nivedana, come back, but slowly, gracefully. Bring the Buddha with you, don't forget. Sit down like Buddha for a few moments and remember the space you have been in, the path that you followed, and the same path that you have come back. Remember it, you will have to be going again and again on the same path to drink from the sources of eternal life. Okay, Manisha.
Yes, Bhagwan.
Can we celebrate the gathering of the Buddhas?
Yes, Bhagwan.